At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. This is a special Best of Caller Questions InvestTalk compilation program. Remember, the InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART. They will be played and answered on an upcoming InvestTalk podcast.
Welcome to InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. We try to bring you useful information and answer any questions you might have, as long as they're financial. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278.
Hey guys, this is Matt from Merced. Just love the show and everything you guys do and find it very educational, so thank you. My question is about relative strength. I'm curious just how it's calculated and what length of time is typically used when they're calculating relative strength of a company versus the market, as well as what the near-term performance is typically, you know, if there's any statistics based on if a company has or 90 for relative strength, or if it's lower, do they typically underperform? Is there a sweet spot where you would find better near-term performance? Just curious, any information you guys have on that? And thank you again. Bye-bye.
Well, typically, relative strength is looking at the last 52 weeks of market performance and comparing what that stock's performance is looking at all the different names in the market, and whatever number that is, it's outperforming that percentage. So if the relative strength is 32, that means over the last 52 weeks, it's outperformed roughly 32% of all issues. Now, that just kind of tells you what's happened in the past. It's helpful, I think, more in relation to different companies in the sector than anything else, to see, okay, what's been outperforming over the last year or not. Because a lot of that last year's performance of a particular company is related to how strong the sector is. Now, if a stock has a relative strength in the 90s, meaning it's outperformed 90%+ of the market over the past year, or the stocks in the market of last year, then those trends, they tend to stay in place. Now, that doesn't mean that you just go buy those, because they also have probably the biggest risk of reversing dramatically, because they went up so much because the market's pricing in a much brighter future. And as long as that brighter future holds, that trend will likely hold. But if there's some sort of earnings disappointment, they can drop dramatically, 20-30% in one fell swoop. So be cognizant of that. Outside of that, I don't know if I would use relative strength for a buy or sell decision. I think it's more of a piece of the puzzle to take stock of, shall we say? Pun intended.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think how I like to think of it is, you buy a company for its fundamentals, and you decide when to buy a company based on its technicals.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And relative strength is a very simple technical indicator. Now, there's a lot better ones. We tend to use more moving averages, patterns, for example. Consolidation patterns are also much more helpful than a relative strength number. But thanks for the call.
Managing multiple mutual funds, researching professional services, where to put your savings. If it's about money and if it's important to you, we want to know more about it. We're here for you. 888-99-CHART is how to reach Steve or Justin right now on InvestTalk.
Hey guys, I love the show. I got a quick question about 401k investing. My company offers a pre-tax allocation that I can invest in. I know what the difference is between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA, but could you tell me what the difference is between a pre-tax contribution versus a Roth IRA? Thanks.
pre-tax is just simply a traditional 401k, right? You're not paying tax on that pre-tax. A Roth contribution or Roth investments are post-tax, meaning you've paid the tax on that and you don't have to pay anything into the future. It's that simple. I think sometimes you get people get all fancy with the language, but it's that simple. Pre-tax is traditional IRA 401k. Post-tax is Roth IRA 401k.
Hi, this is Kevin calling from Southern California. Recently, you guys were talking about 529s. I'm wondering if it's better to hold the 529s in my name and my wife's name versus holding them in my kids' names, just because I know that they would need to be claimed on like financial aid applications. So I'm wondering if it's better to hold them in my name until they actually are about to use it for education, and then transfer it over to their name when the time comes. Hopefully we can hear your thoughts on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, so as recently as last year, if a parent owns a 529 plan, for FAFSA, it's assessed at a maximum rate of about 5.5%, 5.64%, versus when a child, when it's under their name, it can be up to 20% in the FAFSA formula.
So it makes sense.
At least from from a pure federal student aid impact perspective, you do benefit from having it in the parent's name versus the child's name.
That makes sense.
You can call right now and be part of the program. Let's hear about what your talking point is. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278, and you can get through right now.
InvestTalk callers make each podcast unique.
I was calling about Intel. If it's worth holding on to, or should I sell it?
Their questions are curious.
Hello. I had saved up around $80,000, and I was wondering what I should do to make it grow.
Careful.
I'm just wondering, is this a value trap? Because it looks like it's gone down quite a bit.
Concerned.
It's taken quite the tumble today. I've been trying to get out of this position for a while. I think I waited too long.
And clever.
It does seem to be situated in some areas of expanding population.
And Justin Klein, Steve Peasley, and now Luke Guerrero are always ready with their unbiased answers.
And this is, it looks like a classic example of chasing yield. Don't chase the yield.
Next 12 months price to earnings is around 30. I just don't see it at this price.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Let's grab another caller question from 888-99-CHART.
Appreciate what y'all do. Y'all are the consistent part of my day. Thank you. Question on volume and really just capitulation. So if you're looking at a stock chart and some of the data on it, when you're looking for capitulation, is there a general rule as to where what you're looking at, say, volume is three times the average all of a sudden that day, or compared to, you know, that day versus 3 months? What are you looking for on a capitulation type day, and where do you find it? Like if you didn't get to look at the market for a day or two and you saw a big movement, so you go to research it, where do you look for that volume, and how do you know what really truly is? Is it two times, three times the amount that the activity of the investors is showing you? Okay, you know, sentiment is this and that. What do you look for in terms of volume and capitulation? Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
Good question. And typically we're looking for roughly double, maybe triple the 50-day average volume. And so what he's talking about is when a stock is maybe in decline, and this could happen the other way, where stock's in a huge uptrend and then suddenly there's just a huge spike in volume. Oftentimes that's capitulation of shorts out of the market or out of that position, saying, okay, I've had enough pain, and they cover their positions. That gives the market, that stock a surge higher. And then once the volume kind of goes back to normal levels, you can oftentimes get a reversal because of, like the caller said, a capitulation. They're capitulating to, okay, I've had enough of this. Either we're short and it's gone up too much, or we're long and it's gone down too much. fear sets in, and that giant surge in volume, like I said, at least double, usually triple the 50-day average volume, that's a signal that, okay, we've reached max fear on the downside or max greed on the upside. You typically also want not just that spike in volume, that's one indicator, but you also want that reversal follow through. Meaning, typically what happens is when a company market is down significantly, you get that capitulated volume on intraday, you reverse that same day and you close at the highs if it's, you know, the stock's been down, or vice versa, where stock's going up, it has huge volume, big candle, all-time highs or 52-week high, and then it reverses and closes near the low of the day and then gets follow through that same direction the next day. And so that's what you're kind of looking for. Now, we have charts. We use professional charts and volume. There are free stock charts, stockcharts.com. It's a decent one. It's not amazing, but it's, you know, it's decent. Nothing compared to the, you know, our professional tools, but, you know, it could work if you know what you're looking for. But that's the way you think about capitulative volume and whether or not you've seen it or not.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future.
Would this be an opportune time to get into annuities?
Everyone's situation is different.
Get your thoughts on CRM, Salesforce.
And so are their questions.
And I was just calling for your assessment of Blackstone Incorporated.
24/7, rain or shine, InvestTalk is made better by the power of you. 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Chris in Maine. He wants to talk about the Japanese stock market.
Yeah. Hey, Justin. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate all that you guys do. I know over the past few months, I've heard you mention a couple times just in passing how they've been really improving their stock market overall over the past couple years, really, from, you know, decades of lows. And then it's no secret that Buffett, in his recent letter to all his investors, he seemed pretty optimistic on them, but it's really rallied. So I was calling to see, get your opinion, if you think this rally could continue for a while, or if more of a, it's a wait for a pullback at this point. Sumitomo, S-S-U-M-Y, is one of the stocks I've been looking at over there, but more just the market in general as well.
Yeah, Japan has certainly resurged, and a lot of that is corporate reform. You know, they were the China before China, and they had a real estate boom and a bust, kind of like China's going through right now, and a demographic demise like China is going through right now. Now, it's definitely different in some ways. Obviously, it's a democracy. It's a series of islands, a different different customs than China has, but in many ways they're more innovative. They were smart to diversify their businesses away from manufacturing in China because they knew they didn't have the people. So that's why you have a lot of Honda and Toyota manufacturing plants set up here in America. And from a political standpoint, they've kind of tied their hands to America as well. So all of that I think is good. Is they've done a lot of smart things, and they've reformed some issues that were left over from that period. They did a lot of bad things back then by merging bad banks with good banks and making meh banks, right? Not writing off bad assets and things like that. But, you know, we're 30 plus years on, and a lot of that has healed with time. And so I think there is more runway longer term. However, near term, especially when you start to see articles written about it, you typically are get it's ready for pullback. And so I would be patient on it. I have no problem with Sumitomo, a very large conglomerate there, but it is overbought and I would wait for a pullback. Thanks for the call. Now let's play another listener question from 888-99-CHART.
Good morning. This is Duncan from New York. Thank you for all that you do. I have a question on your services. If we get a portfolio review and we still have a lot more questions, is there still a possibility where we can pay for the hour? I'm sure that would probably help a lot of listeners for other options, but just curious about that. Looking forward to the answer and have a great day. Bye.
Great question. But the answer is no, that's not something we do. I do answer questions from time to time where people email directly and I just shoot them an email back. That is something I do just as a, a nicety for listeners and a thank you to listeners. But no, you know, we charge to manage full accounts, quarterly basis, and build financial plans, do all the things that kind of usher our clients towards financial freedom and their financial goals. You know, we're a full suite financial advisor and full service, shall we say, financial advisor. And if that's what you want, what clients want, that's great. If they, you know, want just kind of one-off advice, we'll give that every once in a while. But there are other advisors out there that will charge kind of a flat fee. I don't know any that are good, but, you know, maybe you find one that is. Thanks for the call, though. Thanks for the question.
You're listening to Invest Talk, everybody. I'm Steve Peasley. We want to answer your questions. Our listener line number is always ready for you. 888-99-CHART. Beginning our experience, we're here to answer your question.
You are listening to an Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. Justin, Steve, or Luke will answer them on an upcoming podcast.
Hi, Steve, Justin, and now Luke. This is Jay from Salt Lake City. I have a question. So the company I work for, they use Fidelity, you know, their 401k program, and a lot of people use their active management or whatever. And I know that they're fiduciaries, but they're also broker-dealers. And what I was kind of wondering is, in a sense, what your guys' thoughts are. I know, for example, you guys do research on companies and sectors, but I don't see them doing that. Could you either touch on what they do or maybe what questions to ask them? I would appreciate it. Thanks again, and have a great show. Well, you have a great show. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for that. Well, Fidelity is just your 401k provider. I'm not sure what active management they offer there. You know, Fidelity is a large organization. It could just be a record keeper. There might be another company that is doing the active management. I know we are working on actually bringing 401k management to our clients and listeners. So be on the lookout for that. I'd need a little more detail here to give you a sense of whether that's good or bad. Know that if it's just Fidelity, they're going to be ones wearing both hats, right? They could be acting as a fiduciary at some points and a broker dealer and others. And a lot of people get advisors confused with their broker. For example, we use Schwab as our broker, but we're not Schwab. We utilize Schwab. Our client accounts are set up for Schwab. You always want a third-party custodian holding the assets whenever you're dealing with an advisor. And we are fiduciaries, but Schwab is the broker dealer. So you may be talking to a fiduciary, I don't know, that's using Fidelity as the record keeper and the custodian of the assets. So that's why I need a little more data. If you want to shoot me an email or give me a call, I certainly can try to get the requisite information needed to give you a better answer. So please do that. Go to investtalk.com and click on the contact us button and send me a message.
Managing multiple mutual funds, researching professional services, where to put your savings. If it's about money and if it's important to you, we want to know more about it. We're here for you. 888-99-CHART is how to reach Steve or Justin right now on Invest Talk.
My question coming from an early investor, pretty young here, but I guess I have some capital here in my portfolio that I'm wondering kind of where and how to diversify it. I currently have SPY, Voo, Tesla, Apple, Google, Amazon, Walmart, and one of my favorites is Airbnb. I guess my question is, you know, what are some of your opinions? I know coming as an early investor, the market can be pretty scary. What do you think of those companies? I tried to keep a little bit aggressive, but still have some type of safety in there as well. And regarding those companies, do you think there's any other companies that are out there that could provide some more growth, especially in the tough markets we're in right now? Thank you.
Well, investing certainly can be scary. It's daunting because what it is at its core is it's trying to take your own financial future into your own hands. And so in that pursuit, it's important to, one, know what you're doing, and two, be disciplined. So SPY and VOO. VOO is the Vanguard S&P ETF, SPY, another S&P ETF. You also have Walmart, Tesla, a handful of large cap names that are also already included in the ETFs that you own. So what you're doing here is you're overweighting some of the largest names in the U.S. market. So if you look historically at U.S. market returns, you tend to get higher expected returns from small caps, then mid caps, then large caps in a monotonic way, meaning the expected return is higher as you go further down the size spectrum. And you tend to get a higher expected return from lower relative price companies because you're buying assets for less rather than buying them for more. That's what a value versus growth company means. You also tend to have higher expected return for more profitable companies. So thinking about what you hold in your portfolio, and again, it's difficult to know without knowing allocations. There's a lot of overlap between those funds. There's a lot of overlap in your individual stock holdings. So if you're looking to diversify, they say diversification is the only free lunch in investing. It's true. What I would suggest is look outside of tech. Look outside of the flashy names. Look for the boring businesses. Look for the good businesses at fair prices. Invest in some mid-caps. Look at some energy names. Look at some materials names. Some of the commodities sectors that are at lows because commodity prices have been lower. So I would say with your individual stock holdings, maybe that's where you take on that extra risk and you look for companies outside of those large cap names that you're already holding through those ETFs. Thanks for the call.
Got a question for Steve or Justin?
Hey, Steve or Justin, this is Blue from Texas. I'm just calling about ticker symbol SAN, Banco Santander.
My question is, how much of your portfolio should you put into like ETFs and mutual funds?
Hi guys, calling in from Germany. I'd like to know about currently Lumen Technologies. I like your show. It's a great add-on. Added value for me to listen daily.
What's your question?
What does it mean when a company's share price falls to cheap prices and executive insiders don't buy more?
You're the best person to ask it.
Hello, this is Duncan from New York. Thank you guys for all that you do. I've been listening to you guys for about a year now, and you've taught me a lot about long-term investing.
So let's go to Mac in Los Cabos, Mexico.
So let's get right to one of our callers. Here's Ken in Texas.
Now is a good time to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
I'm Money Manager Steve Peasley, and we're here to help you get better results, if we can, with your invested dollars. That's our goal. Do you have a question? Check in now, 888-99-CHART.
This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. Justin, Steve, or Luke will answer them on an upcoming podcast.
Hi, what are some ways to find a stock that can grow over a period of time? And when can you predict if that company is going to be firing people or if people are going to be buying it like crazy so I can still make a quick profit? Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you agree with this, Luke, but I think the simple way to know if a company is going to grow over time is if a company has a good, sustainable, durable business. Would you agree with that answer?
Yeah, I think the best predictor of future profitability is certainly current and historical profitability, and not just profits in terms of one-off items, but consistent, sustainable profits. Now, that's part one of the question. The second part was, how do you predict what profits are going to be? Outside of looking at the business, it's impossible. We don't have a crystal ball. And more importantly, the other part of the question, how can you tell if somebody's going to buy a bunch of a company or sell a bunch of a company? We don't know. You can't predict investor behavior. So I think this really just highlights for what seems to be a very young caller to stay disciplined early on in their investing career and not try and chase.
Well, I think it goes back to what most new investors look at the market as. And they look at the market as a way to make a quick buck, in a way, gambling. And a lot of people are in the markets today because of the pandemic, because sports were shut down. They were gambling on sports, and that was kind of their way to potentially make a quick buck. And they realized that, yes, in markets, you can trade. You can make a quick buck if you position correctly. But that is the minority of traders out there. The majority of traders, they lose money, especially if you're in the options market and you're not knowing what you're doing. And so if you're listening to the show, you'll probably know this is not a show about trading. Now, we talk about what the near-term outlook could be for a particular sector, company, et cetera, but we're more focused on investing, finding good companies, quality businesses, et cetera, not chasing the latest fad. If that's what you want to do, frankly, there are a lot of kind of faddish shows that are out there that you could probably listen to. And you have to decide whether you want to be a trader or an investor. Investors, over time, they tend to do very well and make money. Traders, only the very, very best, the cream of the crop, actually make money over the long term. So just a heads up there, and hopefully you develop into the former.
Hey, Steve and Justin, this is Daniel in Tennessee. Really enjoy your podcast, and I had a general question for you. When you give a recommendation on your show for a buy-in, like an entry point to buy a stock, I was curious if I already own it, should I go ahead and be looking to sell it, or should I just hold on to it since I already own it? Just kind of curious for your perspective there. Thank you.
Well, first off, never take one man's opinion as gospel, including my own. This is all my opinion based on over 20 plus years of experience, managing assets, looking at charts, looking at companies. I have extensive experience in this. But even the most experienced investor in the world is wrong. Regularly, often. So just because I say, okay, I think it's going to go down, doesn't mean it's guaranteed to go down. You have to look, you have to do your own research. You have to make your own decision. So once again, don't just take what I say on air and say, I'm going to go do that. Take it as an input, do your own research, then make a decision. Okay. And in conjunction with what I say and what your research says, et cetera, you have to think of tax consequences, for example. Is this investment in a tax deferred account or not? IRA, Roth IRA, 401k, or is it in a taxable account? What are the tax implications of that? A lot of times when I say, hey, it's here now, this would be good support level, it's down 10, 20% from where it is today. And what that probably means is that from a risk reward perspective, it's not great after this run, for example. And maybe there are better opportunities now to get into. And that's what you always have to think about. Most people forget about that. And it's a simple concept that we learn very early on in business school. It's called opportunity cost. Every amount of capital that you have invested, whether that's in equities, bonds, real estate, whatever that is, there is an opportunity cost there. Meaning you can go take that money and invest it elsewhere and potentially get a better return. And oftentimes that is an underappreciated way of thinking about how to assess your portfolio, how to assess your holdings. Most people do it based on, oh, am I even? Has it been up? Am I happy with the investment or the sector, or the economy? And the reality is those things are fickle. Asset classes, sectors, companies, sentiment ebbs and flows. And usually when you're the happiest with it, it's the time you actually want to probably trim it, reallocate to that with something that has a better future prospect of returns. And when I say future, I'm talking an extended period of time, because a lot of people, they focus too much on just the short term, and that's trading. But we're investors. We're looking at companies based on the merits of their business, their leadership, their assets, and comparing it to others and constructing a portfolio that makes sense based on the current market environment. And if you're not thinking that way, then you're not going to open your eyes to the fact that there is opportunity cost in everything you own. And so that's the way you want to think about it. Not because what I say is gospel, but because, hey, maybe you should think about redeploying that capital better.
Why do listener questions make InvestTalk better?
Which of these would you recommend?
Because each caller presents fresh questions in their voice.
When do I know the right time to take profits?
And listeners instinctively realize that InvestTalk uniquely offers a welcome dose of investing satisfaction.
I think you have a terrific show, and I've learned a whole lot.
So don't forget to call InvestTalk.
888-99-CHART.
Hello, my question is about a 457 retirement plan. It's not something that I've heard many people talk about. I know it might not be offered from everybody's employer. But it's my understanding that that is an account that you can withdraw from when you retire, even if you're not at the retirement age of 59 and a half, and it's taxed just like a 401k. I haven't heard much about it, but I just didn't know if you guys could extend on that and give any insight about that account. So thank you very much. I'll be listening on the podcast.
Are you looking at a 457 plan? And the answer is, yeah, you can, after you leave your job, take penalty-free withdrawals. But your company obviously has to offer that. And typically 457s, I believe, are typically government jobs. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, with investing in a 457. They're like you said, they're just like 401ks. They have a little different rules, and you have to look at what they are. They have different limits. There are catch-up contributions that you can make, etc. Yeah, it is a bit different. And all these retirement plans, they have their own wrinkles, but it depends on what your company offers. And certainly it's important to go into your contributions with your eyes wide open, understanding the rules. And that goes for anybody that has a 403B or any other type of workplace retirement plan. Don't just throw money in it without understanding your options of taking money out, the tax consequences, etc. Thanks for the call.
My name is Dan. My question was how you guys determine when you say that a company has a lot of debt or doesn't have much debt. How do you determine that? Thank you.
Well, the amount of debt is going to be in relation to the cash flow of the business, the earnings of the business. So it's all relative what a lot is and what a little is. We have a lot of data tools, FactSet, et cetera, that we can look at the numbers in aggregate and total, but also we can even dig down to what debt they have with different banks, right? With the revolving credit line, as well as the bonds they have outstanding, et cetera. So it depends on what, there's a lot of ways that we can see that. Now, you as the novice investor, you're not really going to have access to that data. But Luke, they can certainly download the reports, their earnings reports and their balance sheet and do the analysis themselves, right?
They can, yeah. And it's also important to note that it's not just what debt they have, but the maturity level of that debt, when it's going to mature, rather. So, two companies, one having $60 billion due, all else equal, 5 years from now, and the other one's pushing it out 30 years, those debt levels are not the same because one of them's going to have to roll it for likely higher interest rates. There's a lot going on there. So taking a look at total debt is important. One thing that we look at that we mention frequently is interest rate coverage ratio. So taking a look at how your actual profits are able to pay off your debt, how leveraged are you, is important. But I think the main lesson here is it certainly is all relative because there's more factors that go into it than just one number.
A lot of times you might see long-term debt. That's debt that's a 1 year out or further. And then you might have your current debt. And that is anything that's due within the next year. But long-term could mean, as Luke said, could mean 18 months it matures or 18 years. It just depends on the company and how long they've termed out their debt. And that's one thing that's happening right now. Just a side note here is everyone's talking about higher interest rates and how that's going to impact the economy and these companies. Well, a lot of, especially the bigger companies, they've termed out their debt at the bottom. When I say term out, meaning they're issuing debts that's going out 10, 15, 20 years, especially because they were smart. They were getting, Apple was getting, being able to borrow at 2% plus for a time. So they were smart to do that over a very extended period of time. So it's very important not just to look at the total amount of debt, but as Luke said, the duration that debt typically has on average. Thanks for the call.
InvestTalk, I got a question for you guys. Looking to see if you could give some feedback on whether, when you purchase options, the fee that goes into the contract to your brokerage, does that count towards your capital gains? And so essentially, like, if you bought one contract and it was 65 cents, you got to pay your brokerage. Does that 65 cents get removed from the capital gains, or are you paying taxes on your full profit with that not being factored in? It looks like when you do purchase it, it does give you a max profit potential, and it looks like it factors in that contract price. But I was just curious, because if you start trading options and you buy, you know, for example, 80 contracts, then it becomes, you know, kind of expensive, and I feel like that should be factored into that trade decision. So I know it's kind of a tax question, but if you guys have some insight on that, that'd be awesome. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Yeah, really simple. Yeah, it's going to count towards your cost basis and the cost of investing. So yeah, that is something you can write off on your potential gain. And so while the system might not account for it, the tax person should. And the amount, and I know a lot of people aren't used to it these days, right? You're used to trade equities, pay some sort of commission ticket. Now you don't do that, but on the option side, you still do. And that certainly counts towards your cost basis.
Just had a question about what you might recommend from an investment strategy for somebody who's going to retire soon, looking to invest some money I just was able to come by, and looking to see what makes sense versus investing in a bond ladder. So I would hold the bonds and just accrue the interest versus doing some of the dividend type stocks, maybe from the Aristocrat or the King type of strategies, and whether or not you would pick one of these over the other, or whether you might recommend doing both, and then what the distribution, would that be a 50-50, or what you might recommend. Again, thanks for everything you guys do, and I'll listen on the podcast for the answer.
Great question, and I'll give you what our experience is with most of our clients who are pre-retirees, retirees, is a little bit of both. Now, a lot depends on your risk tolerance level, depends on your goals, and that's the difficult part here. I don't know what your expenses are. This is what we do for clients, is build broader financial plans, understanding what your income levels are. Do you have a pension? When should you take Social Security? What your expenses are? How much? What's your asset value? What kind of yield can you get from that portfolio? And maybe bonds is enough. Doing a shorter term bond ladder, that's kind of what we're focused on for most of our clients now, on the fixed income side. Maybe that's enough, or maybe it's not. Typically, in an inflationary environment, stocks do better than bonds, and so you probably do want some level of stocks. Now, most of our clients are in what is called our balanced income strategy, which is anywhere from 60-40 stocks, bonds. Sometimes it flips. Sometimes it's 60% bonds. Sometimes it's 40% stocks, etc. But that is, it depends on the environment, depends on where yields are, depends on where valuations are, etc. But that's typically what most clients are in. So a little bit of both, the bond ladder as well as dividend paying stocks. But once again, you didn't give me enough information. Frankly, you couldn't on a call. I need to do kind of a full plan. So all of those are going to be factors: your risk tolerance level, your goals, your income, your expenses, etc. So if you want to schedule a portfolio review, these are things kind of we dig into a little deeper, help you understand a little further. And that's probably what I recommend, because I can't give you the right answer because, frankly, I don't have a complete picture. Thanks for the call.
Let's go to Cliff in La Mesa. How you doing, Cliff?
Hey, good, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Appreciate you calling.
Could you answer a question on dividends for
sure.
Me? On the X day, which is like, what, 2 or 3 weeks before they actually pay the dividend?
Yes.
If you own the stock on the X day, say you own it the day before, and the day after that day you sell it, would you still get the dividend?
Yes. As long as you own the stock on the X dividend date, and that's the date they announce, all people who own the stock today will get a 15-cent dividend when we pay it a few weeks from now. So that's the day you need to own it. You can sell it the very next day, not a problem. And you might be even able to sell it that day, but I wouldn't take that chance.
That sounds good.
So everybody, whenever you hear, well, the X dividend day, they call it X dividend day, EX dividend day. That's the day you have to own the stock to get the announced dividend they're going to announce on that day. Now, mind you, the stock goes down the exact amount of the dividend they're going to pay. If the dividend is going to be 50 cents, the stock price that day will go down 50 cents. Now, it might be disguised because trading up and down, up and down, and down might not see it, but it actually does go down the exact amount of the dividend announced on that X dividend date.
You You are listening to an Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Justin and Steve. My name is Jacob from Arizona. I'm a pretty young investor, and I just had a few questions for you guys. I do have a lot of money kind of sitting in the bank, which I do not like, as I know that money sitting in the bank doesn't really do anything for you, especially when you're young. So I guess I have some questions here regarding the markets. Do you guys suggest, I guess, playing it safer and allocating more of my portfolio towards ETFs and things, or should I kind of play it more risky? What are the best options that you guys would give a young investor here? I appreciate all the information you guys give out, and I look forward to the answer in the podcast. Thank you. Have a great day.
So first and foremost, you are young. You have a long time to invest, which means you have the ability to take on a lot of risk if you're saving for retirement, because you don't need that money down the road. But given you're new to investing, I absolutely think you should start off with ETFs. I'm personally of the opinion that in times of heightened volatility, higher interest rates, non-free money, active management can provide excess returns. But I don't think you have the expertise to do that at this stage. A lot of people never get that expertise. And so ETFs are a great way to get exposure to equity returns, something you should be heavily invested in at your age. And it is a great place to start to learn about the dynamics of liquidity, the dynamics of supply and demand, how markets work. Educate yourself, and then maybe you can take on some of the more difficult, challenging aspects of the market. Thanks for the call.
A quick reminder, if there's a term that you hear mentioned on the program, but you're unclear about what it means or you have a question about it, we want you to ask. It's very likely that you're not the only one with that same question. 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to James in New York, and he was talking about interest rates.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, I have a sizable amount of money in a bank account, just a traditional bank account, and I was wondering, I did not want to expose it to market fluctuations. I was hoping that I might just make an investment. If I want to use that money, it's not going to fluctuate up and down too much. So that's kind of what I was looking to do. Is there anything you might recommend for that, like a short-term fixed income bond or anything of that nature? I would like to avoid CDs.
I would say the best thing, and this is what I use with my very short-term cash. Obviously, I don't have a lot of it, but I use a high-yield savings account. Marcus by Goldman Sachs is the one that I use. Get 0.5%. It's not great. Once again, I don't have a ton of money in there just because it's not something that I want to I can do much better in the markets with my expertise, but it's always good to have a small amount in emergency savings, like you said. And that's not going to fluctuate. It's FDIC insured, et cetera. So that's probably the best way you can go. I know it doesn't sound very appetizing. It isn't very appetizing, but that's the world we live in. And if you want safety and you don't want CDs, and even CDs are not going to get much more than that anyway, I think your liquidity there, your safety, and at least something of a yield better than the 0.01%. I know JP Morgan, that's what they pay on their savings accounts because they don't need more deposits. So they have no reason to attract it. But that's what you're getting over at Marcus. But there are other ones. There are definitely other high yield savings accounts. Maybe there's a few that are a little bit more as well. You can shop for those around on the internet and just make sure that they're FDIC insured and they are reputable.
Hi guys, Lee from North Carolina here. I have a question for you about the financial industry as a business. I have been managing mine and my wife's retirement accounts for a couple of years now, and I've decided to start studying to take my Series 65 exam. Plan on taking that over the summer. Just curious as to what would be the best line of action after I pass the Series 65. Would you recommend trying to start my own investment advisor firm or try to find an established firm to become an investment advisor representative? Or, you know, what would you recommend for someone like me that's looking to venture out into the investment advisor business? Thanks. Looking forward to hearing the answers.
Great question. There's definitely a lot of routes to go. It's been many years. I passed my Series 65 when I was 19 or 20, I believe. So I was pretty young. And luckily, I have my grandfather as my mentor, founder of KPP Financial. And that helps a lot, is really have a mentor. And so I would try to find a smaller firm and a mentor that really can show you the ropes of the industry, the pros and cons, manage around the trends of indexing, which makes our business tougher, frankly. And so I would look for a smaller firm that has a mentor, and then you can maybe grow into being a partner or maybe break out on your own. But a larger firm, you're probably not going to get quite the exposure, the experience you really need. Look for a smaller firm with a great mentor.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.